I may be on vacation, but I am coming in for this local hour because it is a very special edition of the David Sampson Show. David, you threw out to me after we spoke about Jack McKeon the possibility of getting Jack on the local hour with us, but that is complicated for, you know, a lot of people, but certainly Trader Jack. I mean, how can you explain Zoom to Jack McKeon? But we have done it, and Jack McKeon is here. David, this is an even greater achievement than getting a stadium built.
I'm so happy, Jack, that you're here. It's so good to see you. Although I see you with a W on your shirt, and it makes me very sad to see you with a Nationals logo and not a Marlins logo.
Well, I'll tell you, if you guys were still in operation, you and Jeffrey and all, I'd be having a Marlins. But from then on, when they fired me, forget the Marlins symbol.
Wow, forget the Marlins symbol. Well, I certainly want to get into that because David has touched on what happened to the group of Marlins luminaries, as they've been dubbed in the media, and your unfair treatment on your way out, and it's the reason, as you articulated, the reason why you are wearing a world champion Washington Nationals shirt. But I want to start with you where David started last week, which is, you know, the Marlins are coming out of their managerial relationship with Tor Borg, and Jack McKeon's name is floated out. Not really a candidate that was in strong contention, but as it was positioned, was a meeting that was certainly worth taking. So you meet with Jeffrey Loria, and was it Larry Beinfest, David?
Yes,
and Larry Beinfest at a deli. And David tells me you had no idea what Jeffrey Loria's first name was.
That's true. Well, we had it was funny when I got picked up at the airport and went over to the deli. I was there a little bit early, so I was sitting out there on one of the benches outside the deli, smoking a cigar. And I didn't know who I was going to see. I never met Jeffrey before. I'd met Larry one time. Anyway, I see this little guy coming across the street, and I guess about 25 feet from me. And I said, "Are you Jeffrey?" He said, "Yeah, you Jack." And that's how we met. So anyway, after our discussion, we had lunch and so forth. And, you know, I didn't really think I was being interviewed for the job. I was thought I was telling stories and Charlie Finley stories and having a good time with those guys. And we left. I went back to North Carolina. And evidently, Jeffrey went back to the office, and Bill Beck, my good friend who had recommended my name, put my name out to them. Jeffrey went back to Bill and said, "Well, Jeffrey, I mean, Bill," he said, "I kind of liked your guy," he said, "but he sure as hell wasn't trying to impress me. He didn't even know my name."
What name were you calling him, Jack, throughout the meeting?
I call him Jerry.
He called Jeffrey Loria Jerry Loria, and this actually works. David, do you know, this seems like a kooky job interview. Why did Jack McKeon just sort of jump out? Did Jeffrey really respond to Jack not knowing his name or something?
So actually, no, Jeffrey was not happy that he didn't know his name, as any owner would not be happy. You want, you know, there is ego involved in all ownership. All of us have an ego. There was something about Jack. Jeffrey came back from the Rascal House Deli and he called me and he said, "You know, there's a real chance that this McKeon guy can help us." And I said, I was sort of negative about it. I said, did he know about the team? Did he have a plan in mind? And because that's sort of what normal managerial interviews are like. They talk about the team and about what their thoughts are. And Jeffrey said, "Forget all that. Jack McKeon is someone who can come in and he could provide the ability to get this team to do what I know it could do." And I had a disagreement because our team stunk at the time, but I was so happy to get rid of Tor Borg that I would have taken anybody instead of Tor Borg as manager. So Jeffrey said, "We're going to go ahead and make Jack an offer." And I said, "Well, how much are you going to pay him? Because we don't need to pay him that much. And Jack, I love you. I didn't know you at the time. Now that I know you, I would have asked for the world for you." But I said, "You know, we can just give him a little stipend because he's going to be so happy to want to manage."
Well, I agree with you there, except the fact when you'd called and made me that offer, I almost told you to stick it. But my son, Casey, happened to be in the room, and he said, "Dad, don't worry about money." He said, "This is something you love to do." So
that's my kind of guy.
But well, there was a counter offer, wasn't there, Mr. McKeon? Apparently you negotiated a bonus, and that bonus was a car.
No, I didn't. That was a unique situation there. One day we were after a game one night. Jeffrey said to me, "Let's go over to the place in Miami, Joe's Crab." And I got in the car. I said, "Just it's a nice car." He said, "Hey, I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "You'll get us in the playoffs." He said, "I'll give you the car." So, you know, I've had that happen, been met by a lot of people in the past, you know, going to give you something and you never let it. So I just tossed it along and said, oh, another, you know, another BS. But, you know, all of a sudden, things kind of worked out. We were going to win the division, or we won it. And he says, what color do you like? You know, and I said, I like any color, white, black. He said, that was it. And then all of a sudden, about a couple of weeks later, he came into the clubhouse, and early in the afternoon, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing. I'm sitting here." He said, "Well, come on out, I want to come out, and I want you to go somewhere with me." Okay, so we went out the exit there and outside the clubhouse, and he said, "There it is. That's yours." And he had that car shipped in from Massachusetts.
That's super cool. All right, so you do get, obviously, you win the World Series that year, but early on, David told me that you had to really be told who was on the team. You really didn't know much about the Marlins. You obviously had a long storied career in Major League Baseball, but going into the job, were you familiar with the team at all, or did you need a full run-through of what you had on the roster?
Well, you know, David's telling you all that stuff. He don't know what he's talking about. I knew all about this team. In fact, it was 19. Yeah. My last year at Cincinnati is 90. I sat in the dugout in the stadium there in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale. I forget the name of the stadium now. They have so many names, they change it every other week. But I said to my coach Don Gullah, I said, "God, wouldn't I like to manage this team?" I said, "They got so much talent over there, but they're in low gear. Someone needs to kick them in the tail and get them out of here." Well, not knowing that a few years later, I'm going to be the manager. So I knew all about these guys.
Jack, what was your last year managing before 03?
2000.
So when you come into the clubhouse, do you remember the first day of the week that you managed your first game?
Sunday, yeah.
It was a Sunday. So do you remember when we met, you're in the clubhouse and we're talking about the lineup and the players, and that the joke of it is that you were going through and figuring out the names of players, et cetera. Do you not remember that?
Well, I don't remember that. No. Can't remember everything, you know, Jeffrey, you know, I mean, Jerry.
All right. Another thing that I need to get an answer to was, David says that you nicknamed him Sparky because he was a spark plug, you know, this high energy guy. And I think I maybe opened his eyes to the possibility that you called him Sparky because you had no idea what his name was. Can you tell us what the origins were?
It was one day I had just joined the club, and we had one of those calls, conference call. Okay. We had a conference call. I happened to be in there. I didn't know what they were talking about, but Sparky was giving a little speech about whatever the subject was at that time. And I said, "My God, this guy's all right. This guy knows what he's doing." I said, "He's a spark plug." So from then on, every time I saw him, I said, "Well, he's a spark plug." So Sparky, from spark plug to Sparky.
All right. So we'll believe that David was one of the few names that you did know, including the roster and the ownership. So you take over a team. I believe, David, correct me if I'm wrong, there were 10 games under when you guys decided to make the move or thereabouts.
Yeah, I think we were 19-31 when Jack took over. It was sometime in May, and the team did not immediately turn around, by the way. So there was some struggles right after Jack came in, and I was pretty down thinking that this is who we had, this is what we had. And I would go talk to Jack, and he would say, "Come on, just hold on. It's going to get better. It's going to get better." And I had no reason to believe him because I didn't know him well at that time, but it started getting better, sure enough.
Well, Jack, what did you do to make it better?
Well, I just tried to make these guys realize that, hey, there was a lot of talent in this room, but we had to, we had to dedicate ourselves to winning and focus on our job and leave our egos at the door, and let's play unselfish baseball. And then I put up the thing that if we can win one game a week. We had 20, I think it was 20 weeks left. And if we could win one game a week, in other words, be 5-4 for that week, we would end up 20 games ahead and we would win, get in the playoffs. And basically, that's what we used to do. I put a calendar up in my office and every day, you know, we'd have maybe we have this particular week where we'd be 3-4. And Jeffrey had come in and said, how are we doing on your calendar? Huh? We got to pick it up. I said, don't worry about it, Jeffrey. I had a picture of my favorite saint, Saint Therese, on the wall. And one day Jeffrey came in checking my calendar and seeing how we're doing. And he said, and we had happened to lose about two or three in a row. And he said to me, hey, your lady here, Saint Therese, you better talk to her. Get things going here.
Well, you mentioned checking egos at the door, so let's talk about that a little bit. I'm going to seize on it because one of the longstanding rumors about that team, and David has since confirmed it, was the tension between the staff and guys like Josh and Pudge Rodriguez. Pudge, really maybe one of the few players on that team that had enough history in the game to actually have an ego. So how did you manage that situation? How bad was it in reality?
I didn't even think it was any problem at all. It was, well, you know, I had young guys like, you know, Beckett and Penny. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but I had to ride those guys. I mean, I rode them. I you know, they had to preach how good they could be, but they weren't satisfied as me right now at this particular time. But I told them, I said, I don't give a damn whether you like me or not. I'm going to make you a 20-game winner. And I kept on them, guys. And, you know, we had a great relationship. Pudge was great. I disagree sometimes with, I hear some of the executives of the Marlins say, well, Pudge wasn't a leader. But let me tell you something. They weren't down there living in the clubhouse. This guy was a real good leader. And how, you know, it was funny, and probably shouldn't, but one day, shouldn't talk about this, but one day he got hit on the hand. And he was out a couple of days, and he came back. And he was about ready to play, and he said, I'm ready to go, Skip. It's okay. You'll be in there tomorrow. Well, we were beating the Braves, I don't know, 13-0 or something. And about the eighth inning, he left the bench, went up and got showered. And I found out. So I called him in the next day and I just explained to him. I said, you know, future Hall of Famer, and I'm disappointed in you and all this stuff and everything else. And I said, you ready to play? He said, yeah. I said, no, you don't play. You don't play until you stay on that bench and be part of the 25-man team. And when you decide to do that, let me know. Well,
Let me add something, Jack, that happened there, because I know exactly what you're talking about. And we had some issues with Jeffrey on that because he wanted Pudge in the game that day. And remember, before you got there, I think you weren't there when Pudge left the team for a few days that year to go visit his hitting coach. Had you started yet at that time?
I don't know. If I did, it was just a day or two. I don't remember that.
So Pudge had left the team because he was in a slump and he went to see his own hitting coach, and it created some issues in the clubhouse. And then when Jeffrey had always treated Pudge well because Jeffrey had wanted to have him signed. Right. And that's something that we struggled with, that treating players differently. When you insisted that Pudge not play and Jeffrey said he wanted Pudge in the game that day, and you ended up winning that battle, that was critical in our season, Jack, because you showed the players and you showed the front office that you weren't going to take anything from Jeffrey and you weren't going to take anything from me, and that you were going to do it your way. And that if we wanted to fire you, you'd rather get fired than have anyone have input into what you were doing. And that kept going all the way through your choice of pitching rotation at the end of the World Series. And it goes back to the day that you benched Pudge.
Well, there's no question about that, but I'll say this, that after the next day he came in, apologized. And from that day on, he was probably the best leader I've ever had on any club. I mean, he just took command and was very respectful. And when I look back and say, hey, here's a guy that was, you know, cuddled his whole career, no one ever disciplined him. Anything he wanted to do, he could do. Now, all of a sudden, I put a stop to that. And I think it was a wake-up call for him. And I tell you, he was just super.
Well, I'll take the transition that Dave sort of alluded to. Let's fast forward to that World Series. And the staff is really clicking in the playoffs. And Josh Beckett finally taps into that potential that it seems as though you believed he had in while you mentioned that you were riding him and saying that he had the potential to be a 20-game winner. I remember I told the story that I was uneasy about Josh Beckett starting. I didn't like our chances on such short rest. How difficult of a decision was that? Did you have to fight with the organization to go ahead and pitch Josh on 3 days rest in that World Series?
Well, honestly, not trying to throw the ownership under the bus, I didn't ask anybody. I made up my mind, this guy's going to pitch. I first of all looked at it this way. Growing up in New York, I knew the mystic of the Yankees. You know, you get them in the seventh game, something good happens to them. And I said, ain't no way. And Redmond was scheduled, his turn was to schedule the pitch. And the Cubs had beat him around, and the Yankees had knocked him around game one or two, whatever, two. And I said, I can't do this. I said, I know I'm giving up game six to get to game seven. I said, to hell with it. I'm going. So I called Beckett in, and I said, hey, I'm thinking about pitching you six on the sixth game there. With 3 days rest, what do you think? He said, let me go out and throw a few. So he went out to the bullpen. He threw a few minutes out there, came back in. He said, I'm your guy. That's all I needed.
David, how did that go over with the front office?
So, Jack, do you remember when we were flying to New York and the argument that you and I had in front of everybody? Do you recall that or not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love it.
Tell us about the argument.
Well, it was a funny. We'd won. We had a wait. We had a wait on them. We had to wait on the Yankee-Boston game to see where we were going. We didn't know. So we had clinched the day early, and they had to play. So we're sitting around a hotel in Chicago, and we had made an agreement that we were going to leave at 10 o'clock. Well, we figured we'd know by then, right? But the game was going into extra innings. Well, all the guys were out of our rooms. They put us out of our rooms. Now the guys are hanging around a bar, and they're getting disgusted. So I see my traveling secretary, Bill Beck. I said, what time is this 10 o'clock bus leave? And it was about 10:30 then. He said, well, you know, David and not David, but Larry, and said, well, we'll wait a little bit. I said, call up there and tell them, get their ass down here because we're leaving. And when they came down here, I was mad. I was mad. And I saw Sparky off the elevator, and we got into it. And I said, oh, damn it, I'm running a country club here. I'm trying to win here. I want to win.
So, David,
my wife kept saying, shut up, you'll get fired. I said, fire my ass. I said, I'm going to win.
David, was this even a consideration?
So it was not a consideration to fire him prior to the World Series. Even
I mean, I never know with you guys. I mean, you fired Girardi after Manager of the Year.
He's downplaying the argument a little bit because he and I love each other. He was yelling in front of the players, in front of the staff, and being so, what I thought was disrespectful and angry. And his wife, Carol, who's the most wonderful, beautiful, amazing woman, is basically elbowing him in the stomach, saying, you have to stop this, because she really thought that somehow he'd be fired right then and there. But Jack wouldn't stop. He was like a crazy guy. He was screaming about, this is a 10 o'clock goddamn bus, and I'm telling you right now, we're leaving at 10. Meanwhile, Larry Beinfest and I are up in the suite, in our suite, because all the players, we had gotten rid of their rooms because it was past checkout time, but we kept our room. So we're in our bathrobes watching the Red Sox-Yankees game. We don't want to be with the team. We don't want to be sitting there in the ballroom, sitting on the floor. So Jack, we find out from Bill Beck that Jack wants to leave. And we said, Bill, tell Jack we're not leaving till it's over. We don't know where the team's going to go. And Bill calls back and says, Jack is losing his mind. And I said, Bill, forget it. Just tell him we'll leave when the game's over. And then Jack got involved. And we found out that Jack was going to take the team bus and just go to the airport and leave me and Larry up in the hotel suite. So Larry and I are furious. We get dressed. We go downstairs. We open the elevator and Jack starts yelling, like just going crazy. And it didn't stop even on the team bus. Right, Jack?
That's right. My wife, I said, shut up. I said, bullshit.
That's great. It wasn't even really the question. I was asking about Josh Beckett specifically on 3 days rest, but you gave us a good story there. Jack, were you doing that in front of the team on purpose, or were you just irked and that they were just casually there?
I wasn't trying to show them up. That was mad. I mean, my desire was to win, and I had it in good frame of mind, and I didn't want them, and they're all griping. I wanted to get that thing going.
I want to talk about some managerial decisions that you made in that World Series. Obviously, the Josh Beckett three games rest thing is what everybody remembers. But I was at that game. Was it game five, the Carl Pavano start and the Alex Gonzalez home run, David? That was game four. Braden Looper comes into that game, and Braden was very shaky leading up to that point, and he was going up against Weaver, and it was sort of like, all right, we both know that one of these guys are going to get lit up like a gas can. Which one is it? And Looper comes in and gets you guys out of a jam. Obviously, I'm sure, David, you were nervous. I'm sure everyone on the team was nervous in that dugout. You guys knew the situation with Braden at that time. Jack, what was your frame of mind in that decision? Did you have other options? You just want, if you were going to go down, you were going to go down with your trust in Braden. That seemed like one of the momentous managerial decisions of that World Series.
Well, I don't remember what, I remember the situation, but I don't know what my thought of mind was at that particular time, but I trusted Looper at that time, and whoever I had in there ahead of him wasn't getting the job done. So I had to go to Looper, who was warming up. But he did a job. I mean, he slacked off a little bit towards the end of the year when we went to Lubina. But then, we had to come back and use him in certain situations, and he did the job.
David.
Jack, I want to remind you of something. I'm sorry, Mike. When you're talking about our trust in Braden Looper, you have to know at that time in the playoffs, Urbina's arm was basically falling off. So he was not as effective as you would remember or think in the playoffs, because we had used him correctly. So Jack's view, which I agree with, use these guys till their arm falls off, because we're trying to win right now. But Jack, looking at our entire playoff run in 03, what would you say was the most important half inning pitched by any pitcher at any point? And I'm going to give you a hint and say it was in the divisional series round against the San Francisco Giants. Do you remember, Jack?
No, I don't remember.
Okay, you put in Braden Looper against the Giants in an extra inning game when it was bases loaded. The Giants had bases loaded and Bonds was coming up second. There was one out. And Looper came in and he got out with only, it was bases loaded, no outs, if I recall correctly. And he got out of it only giving up one run on a sacrifice fly. And he got Bonds to hit that towering pop-up, the infield pop-up. And then at the bottom of the inning, that's when Pudge hit the two-run walk-off single for us to win that game. And we had lost faith in Looper because he was bad, or Bina was bad. We were piecing it together, and he came in, and we were worried always about Looper in a big situation. And that was very instructive for you as you went forward through the playoffs, because you would talk to me about the fact that, hey, we've got Looper and Urbina, and we're going to go with anyone who can get outs. I'm not saying Urbina's the closer. I'm not saying Looper's the closer. We just need outs.
But like a real guy that really helped us through the final stretch and playoffs, Chad Fox. I got tremendous confidence in him, that curveball. And the more, and I try to, talk to people today, and they talk about, they got these one inning pitchers today and stuff like that. And I said, some of these guys, you go back to the playoffs. We used our starters in the playoffs with the Cubs that helped us win it. And we used the same thing in the World Series. Our starters were our relievers, because I couldn't trust some of them guys we had in the bullpen. I mean, let's face, except for Urbina at that particular time and Chad Fox. But, you go back and look at Beckett. He pitches a two-hit shutout against the Cubs. We're down 3-2. We're going into Chicago. We got to win. We got a day off on Monday. He wins on Sunday. We got a day off Monday. And I said to Rosie, the pitching coach, I said, if we need a Beckett, we're going to go from an inning or so on Tuesday. That's one day off, one day rest. And we did. So we went with him in the third inning. He pitched one up, two up, three up, down. Okay, let's go for another one. Went for the second inning. I said, let's go another inning. Went third. Let's go another inning. He went four innings in that game and kept us at bay. And then Penny comes in and does a tremendous job. Really, when you come down and look at it, Penny probably could have been the most valuable player in that World Series because he won two games.
Yeah, Penny was tremendous. And there was some talk about that. It seemed as though Beckett would go on to have other great moments for Boston, but it seems as though everyone on that staff was clicking, because you guys went through some really difficult pitching staffs in that playoff run. Schmidt was pitching as well as anybody in the game. Wood and Pryor, you guys had to go through that. Let's talk a little bit about that Cubs series. I'm glad you mentioned that Josh Beckett game, which is sort of forgotten, and understandably so, considering what happens for the rest of, from that point on in that series. But that's a game that Beckett starts touching like triple digits. I still think that radar gun was juiced at Pro Player at the time, David. I can't believe that he dug down and found that.
We actually wanted to underjuice it because Jack came to us and said, do you know that Brad Penny, all he does is look around after he pitches. He looks back to see how hard he's throwing. And so Jack said to us that he said, why don't we change the radar? Because I'm tired of him looking back, either shut it off, which we didn't want to do because we, the fans liked it, you know, the fan liked it. But Jack was very conscious of these pitchers and how this is, remember, 17 years ago, where not everybody was throwing 100 miles an hour, where upper 90s was not something you saw very often. And Jack was very focused on that because remember, Jack, those pitchers were so young and they were velocity obsessed.
Well, you know, the funny thing is you talk about Penny. I know I never forget when I got there talking to Larry. Wait, he's got to get rid of this guy. Can't pitch. Can't do this and that. I said, look, let me have him for a month. Let me have him. Don't make a move yet. Let me work on him. And I worked on his head, and I mean, oh, at the end of the year, I had this guy sitting alongside of me talking about pitching. And that's how, you know, because of the fact that I was a teacher when I took over. I mean, I'd on that bench, and, you know, I'd see a situation, and I'd go down the bench, and I'd talk to these guys about that situation. And it leads me to another one. That time I locked the clubhouse door. Well, this day was somebody was pitching, and I saw a mistake out there, and I wanted to go over and bring it to the attention of the pitchers. And I go down to the end of the bench, and nobody's there. Who the hell are these guys? They're at the clubhouse. Okay, so I sneak up the clubhouse. I get them all out of there. And then I get mad, and I put a ban, lock the clubhouse. I told them they couldn't go to the clubhouse anymore during the game, unless they had to go to the bathroom. Well, Redmond, not Mike, the pitcher,
Mark,
he gets – these 8x10, or what, not 8x10, but these cards, memo cards, and he has signs made out, PP cards, poo-poo cards. And he's got them on my desk. You got to go to the bathroom. Hey, you got to go get yourself a card. But that was, you know, that was the fun part of it, because we were always kidding or joking and being relaxed and having fun. And, you know, what was it? My expense or the player's expense, we had some fun. They'd call me different names. I'd call them different names. You know, sometimes I forgot their names, but other times, like the time Conine joined the club, I called him. I forget what I called them. I called them some other name. Go pinch Joe. Go pinch it.
Mr. Marlin Joe Conine?
Whatever his name.
It was unreal. Conine still talks about it to this day, that you're the only manager he ever had, ever, who could not call him by his right name. And it continues to this day where the two of you joke around now. But at the time, I'm not so sure it was a joke.
No, the first time the guy joined the club, and I didn't have much association with him at that time. But I forget what I called him. But now it's every time I see him, it's, hey, Jim. He'll say, hey, George.
Mr. Never Marlin.
Never called each other. I saw him up, and his son was playing up at Duke a couple of years ago, and I went over to the game, and I saw Jeff and his wife, and I said, hey, Charlie, how you doing?
I want to ask you one more 2003 question, and then I want to ask you about your return to the Marlins, and then how you sort of got let go by David Sampson, awkwardly enough, on the orders of Derek Jeter. But take me inside that Bartman game. Really, I think the guy that's most happy about Steve Bartman is actually Alex Gonzalez from the Cubs for booting that TaylorMade double play. Then you start pushing all the right buttons. Just walk me through what that feels like in the dugout where everything starts clicking. What was a turning point that you guys thought it had? Was it when Alex Gonzalez botched the double play? What was going through your mind? And I mean, Hollinsworth came in there, Banks came in there. A lot of guys that weren't really called, their numbers weren't called that often, start making key contributions and that inning erupts. Walk me through that inning in particular.
Well, you know, we're down and we need to, you know, that club we had was a very unselfish club. And it seemed like we took advantage of every opportunity we got. You know, remember going back to the Giants, the guy missed a fly ball in right field, gave us an opening, we came through. And we just kept waiting and waiting. And we get to the eighth inning, and what's his name leads off, with the triple, Pierre. It looked like, hey, this is it for us. We need someone to give us a break. Well, we got the break with Bartman. And then the real break was with Gonzalez when he boots the double play ball that would have taken, us right out of the inning. But, after that, things started to pile on. As I did a show with Bob Costas and Gonzalez and Mike Lowell up in New York one time talking about that game. And I always had a secret weapon. And the funny thing is we get the lead, and now all of a sudden I had pinch hit for or double switch with Gonzalez, the shortstop, and put Mordecai in there. Mordecai comes up and clears the bases with a double that makes it an eight run inning instead of a five run inning. And they always kid me and they say, well, how come you went with Mordecai? I said, because he's been our secret weapon all year long. He's hit home runs and come in and pinch it, hit a home run in the eighth inning. I'd take Mike Lowell out of the game for a pinch runner in the ninth inning, and people would criticize me, oh, how can you take a 30 home run hitter out of the game? I said, I'm trying to win in nine. I'm not playing for 12 or 13. But the guy I put in to play third base would be Mordecai, and he comes up and hits the home run to win the game. So
yeah. I remember that nationally, it was a head-scratching decision, but watching Mike Mordecai throughout that season, he was a player you could depend on, had a lot of big moments. I think he had a walk-off earlier that season, David. Little Mikey Mordecai, the secret weapon. So you guys go on, obviously, win the World Series in Yankee Stadium. David told us about all the great stories there. Your time with the Marlins comes to an end. You retire. Then all of a sudden, David...
We're not finished the World Series. We went out, we get to the World Series, and Jeffrey comes to me and he says, Jack, are you going to have a meeting with your team and discuss the monuments and everything out in Yankee Stadium? I said, Jeffrey, are you out of your damn mind? I said, these guys don't know whether they're playing in Hoboken or New York. We're going to just have fun. And we didn't even talk about Yankee Stadium.
Always interrupt when you got a good story like that.
Jeffrey was furious, by the way.
He was, because Jeffrey's a Yankee guy, so he felt the lore of Yankee Stadium better than anybody, right? There, David.
I can tell you one more story about Jeffrey. We're in New York and playing the Mets, and Glavin's going to pitch against us this night. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. Yeah, Jeffrey, who's catching tonight? I said, Pudge. He said, don't you know that Redmond hits 800 against Glavin? I said,
yeah, owns him.
Jeffrey, I don't give a damn if he hits 8,000. Pudge is going to catch. Well, Pudge hits a two-run homer in the first inning, and we win the game 2-0. So after the game, Jeffrey comes in my office. He said, I'll never make another suggestion to you.
Was that true, David?
No. So the story Jack told is exactly true. What went on behind the scenes, Jack, that we tried to shield you from is there were a lot of moments like that where there would be matchups or his advisors would give him matchups, and then Larry or I would have to go to the clubhouse and say, hey, who's in the lineup today? Are you thinking about catching Redmond, giving Pudge a day off? This is because winning in New York at Shea Stadium was critical for us because he didn't like the Mets and wanted to win. And you were very difficult in those situations, Jack, because you really didn't care what anyone suggested in any way at any time, except we had to deliver that message back to Jeffrey.
Well, I don't know whether I never looked at it that way, but all I can say is that of all the clubs I've ever worked for, you, Jeffrey, and the whole organization, that never bothered me. I mean, it was nobody coming in and telling you how to do this. We hired you, do the job, get us to the World Series, and that's what I did. But no one ever bothered me. Nobody, I tell people, like, how difficult is it? I said, that was the easiest club I ever worked with. They were great. It was like a family.
Really?
They let me do the job, and I don't think they criticized it. They may criticize behind my back, but I didn't care. I delivered.
David, how much is this just Jack's MO? And how much was it true when it just came to Jack? Jack probably bought a lot of capital, especially with that World Series with you guys. But that goes against the narrative of your meddling ownership.
So I think that what happened was after 03, as we went into 04 and 05, we struggled those years and we kept thinking, you know, we had a team that we thought could get it done in 05, and it just became a struggle. We couldn't recapture that 03 magic. And I think Jack would agree that the 05 season was just a big disappointment. And I think that if you look to a game, Jack, that defined that 05 season and where the frustration level had just boiled over would be that game in Houston with Clemens pitching against Dontrell. Do you remember that game, Jack?
No.
Oh, I remember that game. I was at a Coldplay concert in an amphitheater and you guys were in a wild card chase and we absolutely needed that game. And I was so worried that we were playing Clemens, who I had thought I'd seen retire, and got out of my seat and gave him a super nice gesture. All those terrible baseball fans here in Florida doing the right thing. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, this guy's eliminating us from the playoffs. That was a massive game. Who started that? That was Dontrell. Burnett also pitched.
It was Burnett. Thank you.
Yeah, look at that. Photographic memory while I was at a Coldplay concert. Yeah, that was the most heartbreaking loss of that season, David.
Well, we were a family, Jack. We were family, and that's something that you don't hear talked about with the Marlins now since the sale, that sort of family atmosphere has definitely gone away, Jack.
Well, there's no question. And you go back to the 5 team. We didn't have that family group there. We had a group that wasn't. Probably another year we could have straightened it out. The only thing I disappointed, I should have been the managing opener in that stadium. You would have been a success.
Well, Jack was brought back after a retirement. David, can you walk us through quickly how this decision came about? Because as a Marlins fan, I obviously love seeing a World Series champion back in the dugout, but Jack was getting older, and this was certainly a curious decision. And it kind of went on a little bit of a run.
I'm older. Hell, I'm ready to go right back now.
I don't doubt that one bit. Go ahead, David.
Jack, it's what happened after 05. As you know, we went through a bunch of managers and we were looking for Jack. That's the bottom line. We spent the rest of our careers chasing Jack. And there's a little nod to chasing Amy. And that's really what we were doing, trying to find someone who could bring that respect to the clubhouse, bring that understanding of how we like to operate, who was willing to do it the way he wanted, but understood that dealing with me, dealing with Jeffrey, dealing with Larry, dealing with Mike Hill, it was all part of the job. And we were going through another managerial change. And Jeffrey said, you know what? What about Jack? You know, he's still with us. We still talk. And I said, listen, we have to talk to him, but the rigors of the game are hard and the travel's hard. And I was worried about Jack's age. And we spoke to Jack and Jack was ready to go. And so we made that switch. And I remember walking into the clubhouse your first day back for round 2, Jack, and it felt really good.
Well, I enjoyed coming back. And like I said, you know, I realized coming back this time, hey, you know, I don't think I can work at Magic with the club we had at that time. But I did remember one thing of preaching to the guys, hey, if we get to 500, we're going to take off. And we got to 500, if you remember. And all of a sudden, Ramirez went down, second baseman, Infante went down, a pitcher went down, and we had nothing to bring up. And that killed us right there. That was the end of that. But I firmly believed that I could have turned that around to having a winning season. Maybe not making the playoffs, but at least having a winning season. But yeah, Unfortunately, it didn't work out.
Yeah, I want to talk to you. You stick with the Marlins organization as what's been described as a luminary. Let's fast forward a little bit to conversations start happening, and it seems as though Jeffrey Loria is going to sell the team. Derek Jeter then gets the team, and controversially lets go of these Marlins legends, Tony Perez, Andre Dawson, and you're among them. How did you, obviously this is an awkward conversation, David had to have it to you. Maybe I'll cede to David here. David, walk us through what exactly happens there and the heartbreaking conversation you have to have with Jack.
So Jeter knew that we had Dawson, Perez, Conine, and Jack, and they were assistants. Conine, Perez, and Dawson, their titles were assistant to the president, special assistant to the president. Jack's title at that time was special assistant to the owner, who was Jeffrey. And when you're selling a team, there are lists of people and what their job titles are and what their salaries are. And I was told pretty early on during the process with Derek that was going to be four positions that he was going to not continue with. And I explained that I think it would be wise to. These are people connected to the history of the Marlins. Jack won the World Series. Jeff is Mr. Marlin. And Andre and Tony are two Hall of Famers. These are two legends who will dress during spring training. They'll be helpful. They'll go to the minor leagues and look at your players. There's just a presence of having these type of people. And Jack was always very clear when he came in that having that presence, it's just nice to see. But Derek was a no. And Derek had said to me, you got to contact them and let them know that their contracts are not going to be renewed. And so I made the calls. It was not comfortable. But the real part of the story is what happened after, because there was a bunch of heat put on to Derek. And Jack, could you take over? Because I believe that Derek or somebody at the request of Derek contacted you, realized they had made a mistake, and wanted you back. How did that go, Jack?
Well, after you told me, which I knew, and I understand, you know, I've been through ownership changes, and they make their, you know, make the guys available that to be sent on their way home and bring in their own people. I understood that. So after the pressure was put on, evidently, Jeter, I got a call from one of the gals at the office and called me and said, Mr. Jeter, we'd like to have your number. Is it all right to give it to him? I said, yeah, fine. So he called me and gave me all that rigmarole. We want to discuss this situation. It's don't believe what everything you read in the papers. And we're going to get, we're going to make some changes, but we certainly like to talk to you and maybe see if we can't work out something. I'll be back with you in a couple of weeks. Okay, fine. Well, let's see. That was September of what year did you sell the club?
That was October of 17.
Okay, that was September 17. I got the call. And this is what, 20? Well, I'm still waiting to hear from him.
Oh, man.
And then Mike Hill calls me and says, hey, we're going to, terminate you because you don't live here. Oh, I said, okay, thanks.
How heartbreaking was that for you to go through, Jack?
Well, it wasn't too bad because I hated it. I probably realized that of all the years I've been in baseball and all the years I've managed in the major leagues, that probably Miami was my favorite spot. I thought that I had a love relationship with the fans, and they really treated me great. And I love being down there, and I love used to come back, just for, like David said, come back and spend the week down there. And all I did was I couldn't walk through the stadium without getting 50 pictures taken, sign autographs. The people love me, and I love them. And that was the toughest part of leaving. Outside of the new ownership, that's their prerogative. I don't have any fault with them making changes. I just don't like the way they did it.
I mean, I don't think anyone listening to this would agree that they handled that the right way. David, obviously, you're not running things, and this would have never happened if you were still with the club. Any advice for Derek Jeter? I'm sure you have plenty, but this man should certainly be honored. He is, when you think about Marlins managers, he is the first face that comes up. What would you do here?
I wanted his number retired. I had a lot of thoughts of what we would do with Jack. And what's sad to me, Jack, is that the anger that Derek has toward the old regime, the upset that he still feels about losing. Remember, he was on the Yankees team in 03. Do you know that we have the 03 World Series trophy? And it was in a case. So when I went to my office, I got to look at that World Series trophy every single day. And I don't know if you know this. No one's been told this before, but it is true that Derek Jeter's now in my office. And he had the World Series trophy moved because he didn't want to look at it. And what's interesting to me about that is the hurt he feels both about the World Series, the anger about the price he paid for the franchise, but is fine to take it out on me. But what he's done is basically erased everything about that 03 team out of the ballpark, erased relationships with all of the people. And that to me hurts the fans and it hurts the memory of it. The reality is we embraced 97. I wasn't there for the 97 World Series, but we celebrated the 97 World Series because we're part of a franchise. And that to me is what's disappointing because Jack, you deserve to be at Marlins Park. You deserve to be around those fans and they deserve to be around you. And that's what's missing. And seeing you with Washington, it just feels wrong. And I never would have let that happen. And no owner should ever let that happen, Jack, because you're a forever Marlin to me.
Well, the funny part of it is, and they I don't think they realized how much that Tony, Andre, Jeff, and myself could have helped them PR-wise in that opening season that they after they bought the club. And I don't think they realized that the influence that we had on the people down there.
Yeah, it had an adverse effect. Also, you mentioned the 03 trophy, and it is kind of weird that someone that's running the ball club was actually a player on that 03 team. I understand it being difficult to look at because it probably, everything that we've ever heard about Derek Jeter, ultra competitor, probably stings him, that 03 World Series loss, no doubt. But to turn away from history when, for such a young franchise, this team has two World Series trophies, obviously not great when you're trying to lean on what history you got. And it's pretty upsetting what's happened to Jack McKeon. And hopefully one day soon he can be honored the way that he deserves. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time out of this, especially Jack. I can't thank you enough for taking the time and figuring out the Zoom.
Are we done? I go another hour.
Well, I mean, you know what? We might take you up on that down the line, Jack. Thank you so much for doing this. David, hang on real quick. I want to get your review. But Jack, we'll say goodbye to you. We've taken enough of your time for this week. But I think you got some more stories up there.
Okay, guys. Thank you. Enjoyed being with you. And my best to all my good fans down there in South Florida.
Thank you, Jack.
He's the best. We'll give you a second to disconnect, Jack. I think this might be a bit of a...
Oh, it's so good to see Jack, and he's still on. So anyway, that the great thing.
This is great. Where I feared this might happen, but it's okay. We'll get to your review, and Jack can just sit there silently as you give your movie or TV show. It's amazing. All right, just David, what are you reviewing for us this week? Host of Nothing Personal. Make sure to check out.
I watched a movie. As you know, I'm still watching movies every day. And David Spade has a new movie coming out. By the way, for everyone listening, what we're watching now is Jack trying to figure out how to actually leave the Zoom meeting. And he's looking around and he simply cannot do it. So he's still on, folks. Yeah. And it's this is perfect.
Just chime in whenever you got something, Jack.
Wait, don't worry. There we go.
Bye, Jack.
Bye, buddy. I got to... Different. I don't see you guys anymore, but I still hear you.
Yeah, well, you're still in the Zoom. It's okay. Let's push on, David.
So I watched, there's a new David Spade movie that came out on Netflix, which I couldn't believe he's making a new movie. So I watched it. It's called The Wrong Missy. By the way, this is exactly when bad things happen. What's going on right now, Mike, on Zoom? This is exactly what we don't want to have.
All right, we have an admin in the room. Let's go ahead and do this for Jack, because I don't think I can keep it together.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Part of me, when I was saying you can go ahead and leave the Zoom chat now, thought that that might be a little bit more complicated.
This is what we read about on the internet that goes viral when the camera's still on and Jack doesn't know and he starts going back to bed.
We were 10 seconds away from seeing a new Jack McKeon. Oh, you've seen a new Jack McKeon.
Oh, my God. Yes, I have.
I should have asked him about
that. How did you not ask him about the toilet story?
The toilet story. Okay, we definitely have to have him back on. Do you think he'd want to do this again?
Yeah, well, we now that he's done it once, I think there's at least a 10% chance he can do it again.
We just won't ask him to leave the Zoom early.
Oh, God, that was funny. Anyways, David Spade made a movie called The Wrong Missy.
Yeah.
And it's so bad.
Really?
That I was thinking to myself, what happened to David Spade? And he looks older. He's older. That's fine. But did he make this movie thinking that any part of it was funny? That any line? There is a wonderful actress who plays one of the missies, who's a comedian who is tremendous, and I forgot her name.
She's good in it. I gotta find her name too, because I saw this movie and my expectations were so low that I actually ended up enjoying it. It was light, it was short, and her performance in particular, the title character, was, I thought, what kept the movie afloat, because David has aged so much that it's not very convincing as a leading man, even though their relationship is somewhat believable.
And so he's aged as a leading man, but he, to me, he lost to me, he became cynical. So when I go back
Lauren Lapkus.
Yes. So I go back and look at his performances from his younger days and some of his brilliance. And he had a failed TV show recently because to me, he just doesn't look like he's working hard. He doesn't look like he's trying. He doesn't look like he cares. And that comes off on camera. I thought the writing was mediocre at best. I thought the performance by David was so poor that he almost dragged down the greatness of the leading female character. Molly Sims plays one of the other Missies as well. And I just was disappointed because when I see things like that, it makes me feel old. By the way, it happened with Eurovision with Will Ferrell. And so when I see these things happen, it bothers me because David Spade should be remembered with greatness. And if people watch this, they're just not going to feel that way. So I'm going to save you 90 minutes of your time and say, don't watch The Wrong Missy.
Harsh, harsh. We typically agree. We have similar tastes in it, but I guess this is all about managing expectations. My expectations were so low that I actually ended up enjoying it because of the performances. And David Spade looking like he doesn't care, that's sort of been his thing for 25 plus years. So maybe not the fairest of criticisms, because at this point, you got to know what David Spade is. He's a fully formed adult. He ain't changing for anybody. But I thought Lauren Lapkus was particularly great in this role. And I hope for bigger things for her, because she had a spot on HBO's Crashing. That I thought was quite good too, a short-lived show that probably should still be around. It was really good.
And what a great lesson, Mike, about expectations, right? Because I went in with high expectations. And so two people can view the same thing, and the frame of reference they have is what changes everything. And that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, I don't think you can watch it on an airline because it's a Netflix exclusive, but it's a good airline flick, I think.
Perfect way to say it.
Yeah, you've been watching Kingdom on Netflix based off of the strong recommendation I gave from last week. What is your initial thoughts as you're making your way through this series?
I've got bags under my eyes because I can't stop, and it is a tremendous series. I can't believe the acting. I can't believe it's the artist from Billions, Frank Grillo, who I never heard of before I saw him on Billions, is the lead, and he's terrific. And I love all the actors, all the actresses. There is a great combination of fighting, of sex, of sweat, of drama, of drugs, of anger, of family, of scarring. It's unreal. Great recommendation. I had never heard of it, and I have still 25 more episodes, and I feel like the luckiest guy in the world. I can't wait to finish this call.
Yeah, season two, Jonathan Tucker in particular, I think this guy should be a huge movie star. I know I said that before, but his character has the most trauma because of the family dynamic that's going on there, getting pulled in a million different directions. The scenes with his girlfriend at the time, I mean, just truly heart-wrenching stuff there. Natalie Martinez, an actress from Miami, links on in season two, and she does a really great job in that show as well. So I really thank you for taking me up on that recommendation, because this is a very underrated show just because not a lot of people know about it. And I'm hoping that we breathe new life into this series, because I still feel like they got stories to tell, because that third season feels kind of rushed because of whatever was going on behind the scenes.
I'm excited to let people know. I'm going to review it on Nothing Personal once I'm done with it, but it's the best part of my day right now is getting back to Kingdom. So thank you for that.
All right, David Sampson, we will talk to you. Let's do this next week. I'm going to be back next week. We'll text back and forth to see if we should invite Jack on there, maybe trade a few stories behind the scenes. I need to hear this toilet story. I need to hear you tell Jack that you saw him naked and experience that all together. So next week, we'll
be
back.
Great to see him. Thanks for making this happen, Mike.
Oh, no, thank you for making that happen. So thank you to Chris Whittingham, too, who was essential in making sure we didn't see Jack McKeon naked this time around. So we will talk to you next week, everybody. I'm still technically on vacation.